Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the massive demonstrations that took place on Sunday in Hong Kong against a law the Chinese government is pressuring the increasingly compliant Hong Kong government to enact, which would result in Hong Kong citizens protected by the one country, two systems arrangement made when the British left a colony in 1997, being extradited to China to face harsh punishment, particularly if they are political activists. Michael Davis, a longtime professor of law at the University of Hong Kong, who is now a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, joins us to discuss what appears to be the largest of many demonstrations against China's moves against Hong Kong's democracy and its rule of law, with a million people taking to the streets. But in spite of the protests, Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, has said she will not scrap the law allowing extradition to the mainland, while China's state-controlled press is pushing the line that foreign forces are behind the protests. We'll assess whether this will mean open season on Hong Kong's activists, who will be subject to arbitrary detention, unfair trial, and torture under China's judicial system, along with foreigners living in Hong Kong or just passing through, who would also be subject to the new law. Then Michelle Garcia, a journalist, essayist, and former columnist for the Texas Observer, joins us to examine Trump's furious efforts today on CNBC to try to refute Sunday's New York Times story that Trump's tariff threats against Mexico were yet another reality TV stunt in which Trump creates a drama and solves a crisis of his own making so that he looks like a hero. We'll discuss Trump's latest lies meant to overcome earlier lies and whether there will be a backlash from America's 60 million citizens of Latino descent who could vote in such a number to overwhelm the angry white voters who are being manipulated by Trump's racist border policies. Then finally, we'll speak with Lizzie Price, the acting director of the government watchdog group Restore Public Trust, about the recent New York Times expose and a more recent expose in Politico of Elaine Chao using her office as transportation secretary to enrich her family's business and finance her husband, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's political career, since McConnell's net worth has risen from $2,962,015 in 2005 to $26,927,535 in 2015, all that on a government salary of $193,000 a year. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Michael Davis, who's a longtime professor of law at the University of Hong Kong. He's now a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington, D.C., and his books include Constitutional Confrontation in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention from Power Politics to Global Responsibility. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Davis.
Thank you.
So this demonstration that took place on Sunday in Hong Kong with over 100,000 people, massive demonstrations. I don't know whether it's as big a demonstration as the umbrella protests that took place a little while back, but how would you rate this in terms of, because people understand, I think, that China is trying to gradually chip away at the deal that they made with the British to give the residents of Hong Kong the freedoms or to maintain the freedoms that they were used to, and have an independent judiciary from the mainland. But clearly, since Xi Jinping is turning back the clock on the mainland and increasing his control and his cult of personality, it seems to be also turning the screws on Hong Kong. So how do you see it in that broader context?
Yeah, well, I think it's important. Probably the best comparison of this demonstration would be the ones in 2003 over national security laws in Hong Kong, which is so-called Article 23 protest, where China tried to impose these laws on Hong Kong, using the Hong Kong government to do that. And there they had 500,000 protesters. my friends who were on the street in this one said it was bigger. So it's what, you know, way over a 500,000 protesters, probably the organizers say a million. And the only protest comparable to that was 30 years ago when Hong Kong people were marching against what was going on in Tiananmen Square, supporting the protest in mainland China. So put in that context, it becomes, in effect, the biggest protest in Hong Kong since the handover over 20 years ago. And what's going on? Well, China's basically, over the last few years, since the protest you mentioned, the umbrella movement, has been sort of tightening the screws on Hong Kong. There's been, and the Hong Kong government, I would have to say, is largely complicit in this. It's the sort of tool that's being used, and I think the perception on the streets of Hong Kong is that the Hong Kong government sort of represents Beijing and not Hong Kong people. So in recent couple years, a number of the protesters from 2014 have been prosecuted and put in jail. They're languishing in jail right now. The legislators who have been elected in Hong Kong from the pan-democratic camp have been expelled from the legislature for statements they've made about Hong Kong's autonomy and so on. So there's a very tense situation leading up to this. And then at this stage, we have a Hong Kong government that's really not elected by the Hong Kong people proposing legislation that would have Hong Kong people and foreigners, by the way, extradited to mainland China to stand trial for under various charges as defined in this statute. This has never been done. When Hong Kong enacted laws on extradition years ago, it provided that there was a path to extradite a criminal to a foreign jurisdiction with one exception, and that was somewhere else in China. No one could be extradited somewhere else in China. And this was done under that ordinance, which is in place right now, because it was recognized the mainland system simply didn't meet the standards for the rule of law that applies in Hong Kong. Hong Kong standards are pretty much like those in Los Angeles or the United States in general or England. So they're very high standards, and Hong Kong is rated very high. So the people of Hong Kong, when they take to the streets like this, they really are seeing a threat to the society as they know it.
So how did the mainland Chinese government essentially co-opt or take over the Hong Kong government?
Well, this has been really sort of written into the DNA of the Hong Kong model, because, again, this goes back to the anniversary we've been celebrating 30 years after Tiananmen. But the Hong Kong Basic Law was being drafted at the time of the Tiananmen protest. Because of those protests and the gravity of them in China, the Basic Law drafting was suspended during the protest and then resumed after the crackdown in 1989. And when it was resumed, they put planks into Hong Kong's Basic Law, in effect trying to secure mainland control over Hong Kong, because during the 1989 protest in Beijing, there was also a million people marching on the streets of Hong Kong. I actually was in those protests. And so China was very sensitive about that. And so there is this kind of idea that the courts in Hong Kong are final, except if it involves local central relations or mainland authority, then matters could be referred to the central government, to the National People's Congress for resolution. So this is one thing. Another thing that was sort of written into the Basic Law was a kind of a model of foot dragging over democratic reform. Hong Kong people view democracy and have protested over democracy many times as a way to make a government in Hong Kong, to have a government in Hong Kong that serves Hong Kong people and that will defend Hong Kong's autonomy. But China has drug its feet over that over the many years. That's why those umbrella protests in 2014, because China was trying to rig how democratic elections for a chief executive would occur in Hong Kong. So now the chief executive that Hong Kong has is largely selected by Beijing. There's a committee that's formed, but the committee, I think it now is about 1,200 people, is pretty much the way it's selected ensures that about 80% of its members will be part of what's called the pro-Beijing or pro-establishment camp. So the chief executive that's in place in Hong Kong, and the current one is Carrie Lam, is pretty much, controlled. The selection of this person is controlled by Beijing, and Beijing tends to signal who they want in that position. So that chief executive, whoever it is, understands that they're beholden to Beijing for their job.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Davis, who is a longtime professor of law at the University of Hong Kong and is now a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington, D.C. His books include Constitutional Confrontation in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention, From Power Politics to Global Responsibility. And the Hong Kong leader, Carrie Lam, that you mentioned, she said that she will not scrap this controversial extradition plan with the mainland China, in spite of the fact that a million people, as you point out, apparently the local police put the figure at 250,000, but it's more like a million, as you said, Michael. Now, the Chinese state media is saying that this whole thing was cooked up by foreign forces. So clearly, they are in denial about the reality of the difference between the way the Hong Kong people grew up in freedom and the rest of the Chinese mainland doesn't. Although, you know, what's your sense of, is that contagious in any way? Do the people in China have any idea of how much better off in terms of personal freedom and political rights and judicial and rule of law and all of the stuff that people in Hong Kong have? Do they have any concept of how different Hong Kong is from China? Because that's why these people are demonstrating, and they don't want to lose what they have.
Right, and I think the answer is yes, they do. But interestingly, I have never, at least so far, there's no sign that Hong Kong demonstrations sort of infiltrate the mainland or that mainlanders take up these things. I think the Beijing government has successfully distinguished the two, so that Hong Kong in this one country, two systems model, while China, you know, cries to the heaven that it's part of China and Chinese sovereignty applies, for the most part, the one country, two systems has made Hong Kong out to be like a separate country. So while Americans and Japanese and Hong Kongers all have democracy, it's not clear that mainlanders are going to take to the streets and demand the same thing as a matter of fairness, that somehow the way the Beijing regime controls public debate in China, controls the press, controls education and so on, and yet has delivered a fairly rapid level of economic development, that this has enabled most people on the mainland to accept the system as it is now. We have not seen any sort of rebellion fomenting on the mainland. Where in Hong Kong, the very identity of Hong Kong people, the very nature of their society is put at risk by increasing Beijing interference. Hong Kong people have no desire to become just another mainland city.
So how much then does the one country, two systems principle work from the time that the Brits struck their exit deal with China?
Well, I think it really started out with fairly hopeful view in Hong Kong. In the days when this was being drafted in the early 1980s, there was a somewhat of a immigration flight out of Hong Kong. And because everyone knew that, you know, Hong Kong was to be returned to China, and there was a lot of concern about it. But when this model was announced, the immigration flow kind of slowed down. And over the many years since, it has not been a major problem. And some of the people who earlier immigrated, you know, after they secure a foreign passport, are very likely to return to Hong Kong and work there. And they, of course, they like Hong Kong. It's their home. So it hasn't been a problem. But I would really fear if this law is pushed through and this process of interference in Hong Kong continues unabated, that we will see more and more immigration out of Hong Kong by people who can't.
Well, where will they go to?
Well, they're going to go wherever they can. Hong Kong immigrants have been, very welcomed, I suppose, in Canada. So a lot of them have mm-hmm. gone to Canada. Some of them will certainly want to go to the UK and, of course, the United States. Right. Of course, the ones who can are going to be wealthier. So they may be able to find ways to immigrate. A lot of them have already secured passports and the right to live in foreign countries. Hong Kong has a very international population.
So the excuse that the Hong Kong government is using, obviously under orders from the mainland, to come up with this extradition idea is to do with a 19-year-old Hong Kong man who allegedly murdered his 20-year-old pregnant girlfriend while they were holidaying in Taiwan back in February, and he fled to Hong Kong and couldn't be extradited to Taiwan because there's no extradition treaty. So they're using that case as an excuse, I take it.
They've emphasized that, and it's a pretty pathetic excuse because Taiwan doesn't like the extradition bill they've proposed, and the Taiwan officials have indicated that if Hong Kong tries to extradite this person back to stand trial in Taiwan under this legislation, that they will not accept him. So it's a rather unusual situation that the place where they are claiming, to extradite this individual doesn't want him under the conditions that they're offering. There could be alternative routes to do this, perhaps with the assistance of the Legislative Council, which is what happens under the current legislation that's in place. So, and really, Hong Kong people would not be all up in arms and protesting if the legislation was only going to provide for extradition to Taiwan, because Taiwan is a democracy and an open society. What the Hong Kong government has done is sort of bootstrap the mainland into this legislation, and that's the objection.
So the PRC, Xi Jinping's government, are basically trying to using the compliant Hong Kong government, which has changed over the years, and I imagine the Chinese have worked on it. Isn't it true that right across from the parliament, there's this massive building that the Chinese Communist Party have full of intelligence officers?
Well, yeah, it's a building for the People's Liberation Army. So there's a garrison building right a few feet away from the Hong Kong government. This was the British garrison. And so China has sort of on principle from the handover forward insisted that they needed to have this continue as a garrison in Hong Kong. So that continues. And the Chinese government, I don't think is going to change that.
So they're basically saying that the argument being given is that we can't allow Hong Kong to become a safe haven for criminals. So when in fact what the Chinese really want to do is be able to just go and round up all of these democracy activists who are organizing these protests, most of whom are very young, and just, haul them off in the middle of the night to the mainland. And that's been happening, hasn't it? Haven't people disappeared?
This is really not clear. One target, I think, of this actually is mainland of corrupt officials who have gone to Hong Kong. And because there's no way to extradite from Hong Kong to the mainland, these officials find sanctuary in Hong Kong. So I think one target of this legislation is to be able to reach these individuals who I suppose, if the legislation goes forward, will be leaving Hong Kong if they can. So that's one target. The legislation says that no one would be extradited for exercising free speech. So that would you know, in a very superficial glance, suggest, well, then the Hong Kong activists are okay. But in fact, what the mainland official who indicated his support for this legislation said, in addition to, you know, business crimes and other sorts of things, that anybody who acts in a way that threatens national security. So that would be a way of including some Hong Kong activists, especially those who advocate self-determination or independence, such as that. So that it's not clear how far into the sort of pan-democratic opposition the legislation would reach, but I don't think anybody wants to test that either. And clearly, the statement that national security would be one area where extradition would be appropriate would target those people who, you know, Hong Kong had no independence activists until the Umbrella Movement. It was only after democracy was completely denied in that case that there emerged these radicals who thought, well, okay, just protesting isn't enough. We have to up the game, and they started advocating independence, and those are the people, or even self-determination, I should add, and those are the people that have been expelled from the Legislative Council and so on. They're one, a political party, the so-called Nationalist Party, has been banned. So presumably those would be the target if they aim to reach political activists.
Well, I believe an author and journalist has been disappeared from Hong Kong.
Oh, yes. There have been. What it was is booksellers.
Booksellers, right.
They've taken people. One guy, they took him off the streets of Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And then several who were traveling, a couple in China were traveling. They were detained in China and not allowed to go home. And then one was detained in Thailand. And they've also tried to seize people, businessmen, out of hotels in Hong Kong. So there have been a number of these cases of disappearing people in Hong Kong. So this, in effect, would up mm-hmm. that game, that chance to reach people that they object to. The booksellers were allegedly publishing salacious books, some of them even talking about Xi Jinping. So that's the kind of person that was so far reached, and then the corrupt businessmen. But, sure. The national security argument they're making would seem to reach these other individuals, who are merely activists promoting independence or whatever.
Well, Margaret Davis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Davis, who's a longtime professor of law at the University of Hong Kong. It's now a global fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington, D.C. His books include Constitutional Confrontation in Hong Kong, Human Rights and Chinese Values, and International Intervention, From Power Politics to Global Responsibility. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether America's 60 million citizens of Latino descent could vote in such a number to overwhelm the angry white voters who are being manipulated by Trump's racist border policies.
Should I run for president? Mother, should I trust the government?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michelle Garcia, who's a journalist, essayist, and currently Soros Equality Fellow at the Open Society Foundation. a former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review and a former columnist for the Texas Observer. She's the director of the PBS documentary Against Mexico, The Making of Heroes and Enemies, and is currently working on a book about borders and their powerful influence on U.S. identity, politics, and the culture of violence. And she has a recent three-part essay series on the U.S.-Mexico border at The Baffler. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Garcia.
Good to be here.
Well, thank you, Michelle. And somebody recently I interviewed suggested that Trump is not going to give up on using the southern border as a rallying cry to throw or as a constant irritant or an open wound, if you will, which he can rile up his base with, and that will be a permanent fixture of American politics, at least as long as he's in the White House. What do you think of that theory?
Well, it's been the case beyond and bigger than Trump. I mean, the U.S.-Mexico border has been a political weapon now for some time. I mean, I'm speaking to you from Texas, where the border has been for years now in the hands of the Republican administration here, a way to galvanize a political constituency, to create a sense of unified identity, right, even though it's exclusionary, and then also then to create the semblance of having accomplished something, having provided the public with what the most basic of needs, which is a sense, even a false sense, of security. What we're seeing here and all that Trump has done is capitalize on what has been going on now for so long. Look at California. Look at the 1990s with Proposition 187. I mean, this is not, in some way, in some form or fashion, the U.S.-Mexico border has been a political weapon that has been loaded and reloaded now for years, and he's just firing it over and over again. I mean, it's like John Wick.
Right, but in California, the legislature is moving to allow undocumented immigrants medical care and other benefits. That's the opposite of what Trump is doing.
Right, but you had in the 1990s, California was, and then you had Arizona, you had, it was a political tool in California. And a productive one, right. One that paid off. I mean, what you ended up having was a backlash in California, and you have a professor in at USC, Manuel Pastor, who's written a very good book about the political reverberations, if you will, of that era in California, where you had a lot of social mobilization, a lot of political organizing that tapped into that energy post Prop 187 and so forth, and that really brought about that shift that you are now and have been experiencing in California. But all of this to say is going back to your original question, which is the sort of novelty of using the border is there isn't one. I mean, it's something that has paid off for politicians now for, you know, Nixon, right? The war on drugs. So in one way or another, creating a sense of threat on the border and then delivering a real, but more than likely and more often the case, false sense of accomplishment or success or, if you will, victory is something that is, you know, indelibly American in the political sphere, in the political sphere.
So, Michelle Garcia, then, the question would be, is the countervailing possibility, since Trump is throwing red meat to his base and basically sending out this dog whistle to white racist America saying, I'm taking care of you, then the Democrats only care about black and brown people. I mean, that's basically the subtext. So do you think the Latino constituency in this country, and I believe it's like 60 million people of Latino descent in this country, I may not have the figures right, but correct me if you will. But nevertheless, do you think there will be a blowback in the sense that as much as he throws red meat at his base, Latinos are going to get politically organized and vote him out in 2020?
Okay. I think there's two parts to your question. So if I may break that down. The first part is the it's very and it should be very disconcerting and troubling to all of your listeners of all backgrounds of what is going on in regard to the border and with regard to migrants, because what we have here is what do we talk about? Is the same thing that we've been talking about now since the Republican primary, which is Trump as this sort of exceptional figure, right? So it's like, what is he going to do? What will he inflict next? What is the next drama? I mean, look at what happened with the tariffs, right? So create this sense of anxiety and uncertainty and panic, and then deliver a, again, false sense of resolution and victory. Now, add to that, you have a sort of simulation, if you will, of what is actually about to occur, which is, I am going to promise you, my constituents, that I have taken care of, quote-unquote, this problem, right? But what has actually happened is, by sending people to Mexico, and I think it's a misnomer to call it return to Mexico, because that's like saying that you're from wherever your layover was, right? They went through Mexico to get to the United States. It's not in itself creating a problem and germinating a problem that will potentially have fallout in the future. And by keeping people who are extremely vulnerable in a place of high insecurity, place of high crime, high levels of violence, and where they are being faced and confronting extreme cases of extortion and other kinds of crime, and where you have organized crime groups ready to prey on them. So we can only predict, right, what the outcome is, but we already have seen what has happened in Mexico with vulnerable populations in regard to what happens when you don't provide services and treat people like humans, and that creates a fertile ground for organized crime. So in all of that sense, right, you get this false sense of, I delivered. But you delivered what? It's a sort of news cycle sense of delivery until the next thing comes. Now, it's like looking at all the reports that we hear every day on the radio or and reading them in the newspaper and telling us about how the economy is thriving and how the stock market's doing, and yet we've got 40% of Americans can't handle a $400 emergency, right? So tell the people on Skid Row, tell the people that are living under the highway in Austin that the economy is doing well, right? So again, we're talking about these simulations of what is really being delivered. Now, as to your final part of your question, in regard to Latino constituents, I think I had a great privilege of spending time with some Latino scholars in Santa Fe. We are working on an anthology about citizenship and what is happening to citizenship in the era of Trump. And one of the participants is Matt Barreto, who is a researcher and a professor at UCLA and who is co-founder of Latino Decisions. And he's been doing a lot of research on this and has found that, yes, the kind of constant barrage of it's almost impossible to explain it, which is a mix of dehumanization, racism, and just maligning has a potential is to bring together a sense of cohesion, right? The question is, of course, is going back to what I mentioned earlier in my previous answer, which is that energy needs to be tapped and organized and galvanized, right? So that, yes, potentially it could create a outpouring of voter turnout and so forth. But it doesn't just happen miraculously. This isn't, a movie. You need to have, as in what happened in California, a organized, structured, institutional level outreach to tap that political energy, mobilize voters, and at the very least, even talk to and report on that sector of the public. We have already seen how there have been so many reports talking about how young Latinos are going to be such a decisive factor in the upcoming election. Latinos are projected to be the largest non-white voting bloc in the upcoming election. And yet, I would ask you, how many segments do we devote to that? How many inches do we devote to this part of the constituency? To, you know, the multifaceted political climate that Latinos are experiencing right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Michelle Garcia, who's a journalist, essayist, and current Soros Equality Fellow at the Urban Society Foundation, a former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review, and a former columnist for the Texas Observer. She's the director of the PBS documentary Against Mexico, The Making of Heroes and Enemies, and is currently working on a book about borders and their powerful influence on U.S. identity, politics, and the culture of violence. And she has a recent three-part essay series on the U.S.-Mexico border at the Bafala. Well, you mentioned earlier, Michelle, Trump's modus operandi, which I refer to as government by stunt. He's a reality TV guy, and every day he pulls off a stunt and always tries to have a cliffhanger for the next installment. And it's getting tired and it's tawdry to begin with. And yet I'm astounded that anybody takes this man seriously. It's just appalling. And he was totally exposed in the New York Times on Sunday on the front page in an article by Peter Baker, pointing out that this whole reality TV stunt about Mexico and starting tariffs of 5% on Monday, graduating up to 25%, was, and then he suddenly reversed himself and said, the deal's been made, I got the Mexicans to cry uncle. He's also trying to do the same thing with China. And it turns out to be a complete fraud, that the deal was struck as early as last December. Most of the elements of the deal were struck with Mexico. And furthermore, there's something inherently absurd and completely wrong-headed about the idea that Mexico has to solve U.S.'s border problem, which they haven't been able to solve. So why should the poor, under-resourced country of Mexico be responsible for America's borders?
You know, the whole idea that these had been, I mean, even the question of whether these were secret talks, I mean, the Mexican government issued a press release in March outlining what the nature of the talks were and what was going to be offered up, and now we know it's 6,000 National Guard, the recently formed National Guard in Mexico, deployed to the southern border. I mean, mind you, this is a National Guard that has only been in full mobilization, if you will, in February. And this is who's going to get sent to deal and to receive migrants, right? In a country where you have already had countless human rights abuses during the so-called, you know, war against the narco, the guerra contra el narco, the drug war, right? So, again, I go back to, what is this victory? What are we defining as victory in of itself? But second, and this is really what's so troubling and should be troubling to many of us, which is, I think that the sort of, that people are very beleaguered, many people are very beleaguered, feeling very beleaguered by this constant drama, or as you called it, like reality TV, and then we have these conversations about, you know, what has Trump done, or how was the country misled, right? And after a while, and I think this may be the point, it feels almost like it has no resonance, that it has no, you know, you can only hit the outrage main vein so many times before it just doesn't work and it collapses. And I think the thing that we might be needing to focus on here, which is the simulation itself. And I'll give you an example, which is, this is a very much like a metaphor and a parallel to what is going on with this whole tariff, or what went on with the tariff threat, which is, you know, there have been these photographs that get circulated of Border Patrol agents rescuing migrants from the Rio Grande River, right? And they're very dramatic scenes of children, right? And you have the Border Patrol agent holding them and rescuing them from near death. But what you don't see in the photograph is the fact that there are agents stationed midway across the bridges. And that, so therefore, Central American migrants cannot present themselves and request asylum, as is their right, because they're prevented from touching U.S. territory. But that photograph doesn't show you that. And in much the same way, you know, what we need to be focusing on is this, these simulations that are very dangerous and that have dangerous human consequences, and what we don't see. And so right now we're very tied up with, you know, what was being, you know, were we, was the country misled? What, you know, what drama did Trump create? Meanwhile, what is actually going to happen to the very real people who are sitting in Juarez, who are sitting in Reynosa or in Tijuana? And we have to ask ourselves, you know, like I told you, at the beginning, or earlier before we were, you know, during the interview, it's 100 degrees here. Sooner or later, the people who are being made to wait in Mexico are not going to wait. And this may be the ultimate drama, right? I mean, I don't want to predict into the future, which is people will just try to cross. And this, you know, these are the types of questions we need to be focusing on and resist the allure of the dramatic hero, anti-hero, whatever you want to call him.
Well, just in closing, Michelle Garcia, AMLO, Mexico's president, he had a big rally on Saturday in Tijuana and more or less said along the lines that we've managed to keep our dignity intact. He's apparently been trying to convince Trump that the best way to solve the immigration problem from Central America, from the three countries, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, is to make life more livable for the people in those countries. It's very logical. Now, there were programs that the U.S. government had to help deal with this problem at its root, but Trump cut funds. So what we really have here is we have a sensible and compassionate man as president of Mexico, and we have a cruel, insensitive, and cynical man, president of the United States. He doesn't give a damn about the suffering of the Central American people. He doesn't care.
You know, I'm very wary of casting anyone as a sort of good versus bad, because the Mexican president also has his own issues and political reality that he's dealing with. And in that same rally in Tijuana, there were protesters, and I'm looking at the photo right now that says, AMLO, no levantes ese muro con la vida de mujeres, hombres, niñas y niños refugiados, which is AMLO, don't raise that wall with the lives of women, men, children, boys and girls, the refugees, right? So the, you know, he, López Obrador, the Mexican president, is going to quote-unquote host. Pompeo came out today saying that the United States is going to now send, you know, upwards of 10, you know, thousands of people to Mexico to wait out. So what is the Mexican government, what have they agreed to do? Provide housing? Humanitarian care? I'm on the phone, and I've been on the phone now for weeks with a Honduran family in Juarez who move from shelter to shelter while they go to their court hearings in El Paso and still have to go back now multiple times. I mean, you know, this was a short-term solution to a major problem. And yes, as you stated, López Obrador has suggested a regional pact, and this so-called deal that has been reached with the United States and Mexico, in 45 days there will be a review, and then what the next step reportedly is to look at potentially bringing in other countries to come up with a multi-nation strategy, the other countries being Brazil. I mean, so we know what's, you know, Brazil, and Panama. And so right now you have various people involved who are working and trying to sort out their political and economic needs. I mean, look at the peso. After this quote-unquote deal was, you know, announced, the peso rebounded, I mean, averting what could have been a super immediate crisis. So I think ultimately what we're looking at is what is happening, though, to the integrity of the asylum system in the United States. And that is a question that is not is not, you know, insignificant. I mean, we talk about a sense of lawlessness and rule of law, and yet there are major questions about what is becoming of the U.S. obligations under international treaties and under its own laws by these victories.
Well, that is the big question. But, of course, you know, the legacy of Donald Trump will be such that so many repairs will be needed for this country's standing in the world and its health at home that we could speak for a long time further, Michelle. But I thank you very much for joining us.
It was good to be here. Good talking with you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michelle Garcia, who's a journalist, essayist, and a current Soros Equality Fellow at the Open Society Foundation, a former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review, and a former columnist for the Texas Observer. She's the director of the PBS documentary Against Mexico, The Making of Heroes and Enemies, and is currently working on a book about borders and their powerful influence on U.S. identity, politics, and the culture of violence. And she has a recent three-part essay series on the U.S.-Mexico border at The Baffler. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the exposés in the New York Times and Politico of Elaine Chao using her office of transportation secretary to enrich her family's business and finance her husband, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us is Lizzie Price, who's an acting director of Restore Public Trust, a D.C.-based government accountability watchdog. She's previously worked for a variety of progressive groups, including American Bridge, Correct the Record, and For Our Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lizzie Price.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for joining us, Lizzie. And the New York Times did a very thorough investigative piece recently on Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao, who's married, of course, to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And her family business is in transportation. And she is the Secretary of Transportation. And given that nobody of any substance wanted to be in Trump's cabinet, and he desperately needed women or even minorities, because it's largely a bunch of old white grifters, that Elaine Chao could have had her choice of a number of portfolios, but it's hardly a coincidence to think that she chose transportation, since the Transportation Department has oversight over shipping, which is her family's business. She also has oversight over the FAA, and the Federal Aviation Administration totally failed with Boeing on the 737 MAX. They didn't do what they're supposed to do, which is oversight. And now America's most successful export company, Boeing, is in trouble with this completely turkey of a plane that may be grounded forever because it's so unsafe. So on that alone, I think she should be fired for not doing her job. But you feel that there's a lot more, many more reasons, right? So why don't you tell us about them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're completely correct. She has failed at oversight in a variety of different ways. And the troubling thing from this Politico article today is she has sort of set up a system in her own office to favor her home state, which incidentally favors her husband's political career, which is a really big problem. She actually said it herself in a August 2018 event in Lexington, Kentucky, where she announced more Department of Transportation grants there. She said it herself. She said, she tries not to come home empty-handed. And she actually said that on video. And, you know, we released a report earlier this year that talks about how many contracts that she has, that she's actually moved to Kentucky. And I don't think that there's any, you know, you can argue about a lot of things. These projects are valid, but, you know, I think that there are a lot of other states who would have liked to see funding for their infrastructure as well. So it's not so much about what the money is doing, it's the process and who it benefits. And I think that what we found today is that it benefits her husband's political career, and that's a huge problem.
Well, there have been some investigative pieces by the Louisville Courier, the home state paper of McConnell's, about his ties to the Russians and Russian money, oligarch money. Deripaska, the guy that shows up a lot in the Mueller report, the oligarch close to Putin who's allegedly murdered 42 people when he fought the aluminum wars in Russia and took over the aluminum monopoly. And they're putting a big plant down in Kentucky for what seems like a very coincidental reason. Mitch McConnell, of course, was the one person who stopped Obama from having a joint statement when our intelligence services first found out about Russian interference in the elections in 2016. Obama wanted the heads of the House and Senate in a bipartisan way to make a statement warning Russia to stop doing it, and Mitch McConnell torpedoed that opportunity. Why Obama didn't go ahead and do it himself, I don't know, but why? But still, that's another story. What do you think is going on with McConnell in terms of his, I hesitate to use the word corruption, but I can't think of a better word.
Yeah, I mean, I would use that word as well. I think it's a big problem. And you know, it's what's interesting about what McConnell is doing with all of these stories that are coming out that show that the two of them are working together is that he's really owning it in a way that's kind of astonishing. To be honest, he really is holding on to the fact that he's using his power in Washington to move funds towards Kentucky, and he's kind of bragging about it. He's using it as a campaign talking point, and his staff, his political staff, are doing the same thing. They're actually running on the fact that he is connected to maybe not particularly the example that you mentioned, but he's using the fact that the Department of Transportation under Chao has directed an unbelievable amount of money to Kentucky under her leadership, far more than her predecessors. He's using that as a reason for Kentucky to vote him back in. He is going through a really tough reelection in 2020, and I think that this isn't an accident. I think that there is something there, and Congress really should step in and take a closer look at some of this. And, you know, I mean, obviously the New York Times article out last week, which was pretty groundbreaking in and of itself, talked about how they had worked together to set up meetings and that kind of thing. This is the antithesis of, well, there are two things. One, this is the antithesis of Trump's drain the swamp message. That's going to cause a problem for him in 2020. But also, you know, there's something just so secretive about the way they're going about this. We have actually, at Restore Public Trust, we've actually asked, we've done a lot of public records requests into the Department of Transportation regarding these contracts, but also a broad variety of other issues, particularly promoting her family's company. And actually, just this week, we filed a lawsuit to get those public records requests because they're not answering us. We sent these public records requests to get the communications between her office and her family's business in December of 2018, and we have heard nothing. So we actually just filed a lawsuit to get those documents, and that's a really big problem for this administration too. But I think it also goes to show that I think that Secretary Chao knows that she's doing something shady here, and she's really trying to hide it.
Well, one thing that's clear on the record is that Mitch McConnell has gotten very rich in the last decade or so. In 2005, his net worth was $2,962,015. In 2015, his wealth skyrocketed to $26,927,535. So that is an increase of $23,965,520. That's an 809% increase. All this, of course, on a government salary of $193,000 a year. So he's doing well, and it's no secret that the Chow family, the shipping company, and by the way, her father was a schoolmate in China of Jiang Zemin, former Chinese leader. So he's well connected to the Chinese elite, the father. So is that the source of Chow family money? Is that the source of Mitch McConnell's sudden rise in wealth?
Well, it certainly seems to be. I mean, from other reporting that I've certainly seen, he did come from somewhat humble beginnings, and then certainly has received gifts from the family, both personal gifts, but also in the form of political contributions as well. I think this is a mutual beneficial relationship, if being a bit cynical here, but it's a mutual beneficial relationship. But the problem here is this taxpayer money that she is actually misdirecting for his political gain. And that, I think, personal money aside, I think that is the real concerning thing here. What else is going on? What other favors are being traded here? We don't actually know because we don't have the information that we asked for. So I think that's a huge, huge problem that we just can't answer. It seems that she has misdirected taxpayer money for his political gain. And that is just maybe the swampiest thing that we've seen coming out of the Trump administration.
Well, just in closing, how does it differ, though, from normal pork barrel politics, where all congresspeople and senators always try to shove contracts in their district to make themselves look good? And that's why they have all kinds of ridiculous military bases in places that don't need them.
You bring up a really good point. It's actually why pork barrel spending is not even a thing that you can do anymore, and at least, you know, in the way it was done before. But I think this seems to be a reimagining of the pork barrel spending that you saw for so many decades. And I think that the reason why Congress got rid of that blatant pork barrel spending is because Americans are sick of this. They want to see communities compete for funding like this from the Department of Transportation. They don't want to have one community get a leg up in the competition for these really important infrastructure funds just because they're politically connected. I mean, it's just what Americans hate. And it's going to be a problem for not only Mitch McConnell, but also Donald Trump.
Well, Lizzie Price, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Lizzie Price, who's acting director of Restore Public Trust, a DC-based government accountability watchdog. She's previously worked for a variety of progressive groups, including American Bridge, Correct the Record, and For Our Future. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.